Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How many secrets can a democracy have before it ceases to function as a democracy? Under the aegis of defending national security, government agencies and their privately contracted partners have been operating with relatively little public scrutiny for more than a decade, spending tax dollars and deploying weapons not only in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also in places like Pakistan, Libya, Somalia, and Yemen. The directors of these agencies, of course, are not elected, and the elected officials tasked with overseeing their work are often denied access to classified details of those operations. So how can we possibly know what we don't know? And should this be a concern for average Americans? Scott Horton is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, a practicing lawyer and a lecturer at Columbia Law School. His new book is called Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Scott, welcome to Think.
Great to be with you.
Who are the lords of secrecy, and how does secrecy equate to power in the modern world?
Well, the lords of secrecy are the senior echelon of the major national security and intelligence echelons in the United States. They're the people who have the power under federal law to create secrets. And this, I think, as sociologists had established going back about 100 years, this relates directly to power. So the ability to create secrets is used by the senior figures in these echelons to gain more and more power. They use it to make their own analyses and reports immune from criticism or inspection, but they also use it to establish a situation in which only they have access to the critical information that drives major national security decisions, and therefore only they can advise the president and other senior figures of the government about those matters and make the decisions.
You open the book with a detailed account of what certainly appears to be deliberate CIA stonewalling of a Senate probe of the use of so-called enhanced interrogation methods. Many people call that torture. Tell us about the roadblocks that were thrown up to slow down that congressional probe.
It's interesting because this has allowed us to see something that goes on behind the scenes in Washington all the time. But the question is, how do these people who make the secrets, how do they use secrecy to block and delay the process of congressional oversight? Because, of course, Congress fixes their budget, writes the laws, and has a right to probe their dealings. And from the beginning, it's been clear that if abuse of secrecy is going to be held in check, it's Congress has a primary role in doing it. And in this case, we saw them using the power to make secrets to slow down the entire process, to refuse to turn over information, to put all sorts of restrictions on how the Senate and the Senate staff could receive and use the materials. They said, for instance, they had a right to have everything reviewed previously before it was turned over to the Senate, and they brought in independent contractors who otherwise never would have seen these materials to do that. They said that the Senate couldn't take these materials to the secure information rooms in Congress, but instead had to review them on the premises of a CIA facility. They said the Senate couldn't use Senate computer equipment for preparation of its reports, but instead had to use computer equipment that was controlled by the agency. And then later, they hacked into that equipment when they discovered that they had turned over materials they didn't want to turn over. They'd done this evidently by accident. And they played a game using the power to create secrecy to intimidate and harass members of the staff, telling them that they had mishandled secret information. And they, in fact, made criminal complaints against them to the Department of Justice, all of which was, in a sense, extraordinary because, of course, the Senate committee had the absolute right to do all these things. In fact, it was their job. And they're not subject to accountability under these secrecy restrictions. In fact, the Supreme Court has ruled on that issue very, very clearly. They're exempt from it because oversight is their function. So it just shows how the game is played. And I think in this case, the CIA demonstrated very clearly that they're far more able players of this game than was the Senate.
The CIA's budget more than doubled in the years that followed 9/11. It would seem that if nothing else, Scott, lawmakers would demand an accounting of how this huge amount of tax money is being spent.
Oh, well, that's exactly right. I mean, I think, you know, most of the focus here has been on certain programs, which are controversial programs. But a large part of the oversight that needs to occur is on fairly mundane things. It's just whether they're spending money properly and prudently and whether there's proper accounting for the funds that they're spent. And the budget of the CIA probably has roughly quadrupled since before 2001. Current best estimates will put it somewhere north of $50 billion, and the budget for the entire intelligence community between $80 and $100 billion. That's a very, very large part of the total discretionary budget of the United States, and much of it is spent in the shadows in ways where it's very, very difficult to track money being put through contractors, for instance, many of which don't actually appear to really be contractors. They're contractor covers for the CIA. And just a few times when corruption investigators have gotten into it, they've found horrendous abuse and misappropriation of funds. So this sort of basic prudent accounting and oversight of funds needs to be going on in real time all the time, but it's extremely difficult to do.
It's worth noting that just the act of keeping so many things secret costs a great deal of money.
Well, more than $10 billion a year, that's our current estimate for it. So that's a staggering sum of money. But I would say the cost goes beyond that. Beyond the dollars and cents cost, you've got the cost to our democracy, because whenever these materials are stamped as secret and whenever all the basic facts surrounding key decisions are secret, you're taking that off the table for discussion in terms of democratic process. And you're saying effectively the people are not entitled to have any say about how these issues are resolved. And that's meant effectively that we've waged wars in the last 10 to 15 years that normally in the ordinary course in prior generations would have been discussed in Congress, would have been a matter of public debate and discussion, and they have just slipped under the radar screen and not been discussed because of secrecy.
Well, let's talk about that. When we discuss America's wars of the early 21st century, everybody thinks Iraq and Afghanistan. You are adamant that our operations in Pakistan in particular amount to a 10-year undeclared war.
That's exactly right. So, you know, we did have the discussions about Afghanistan and Iraq, but we didn't have discussions about a number of other sustained military operations that went on. And I'd say the most striking example of that is Pakistan. So what went on in Pakistan has been characterized as a covert operation. And a covert operation, this is a term that was established in the National Security Act of 1947, and this is the dark stuff that's done by the CIA. It might be an assassination, there might be dirty tricks, might be an action designed to get in and gain some intelligence, but frequently does involve some sort of violence. And these things in the past have been sanctioned or approved as one-off actions. And I think no one would really have much problem with that as a concept. But what's happened now is that we see a 10-year sustained program that involves, let's say, 300 to 400 drone strikes, 3,000 to 4,000 casualties going on, and it has a very profound effect on the political environment in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and India. And with very profound consequences for the United States. Yet we've had no real discussion about this in the United States. We can't have that discussion because these programs, these activities have been labeled as covert action. And that means that even though we all know it's going on, we know this drone campaign is going on, the government leaders are not permitted to talk about it. So you can't challenge them. You can't have a debate or discussion about it.
So there's 3,000 to 4,000 estimated casualties. Those are casualties within Pakistan. Those are not American boots on the ground.
That's exactly right. And one of the major rationalizations here, which we see going back to a Department of Justice opinion that was issued in April of 2011, is that if we don't have uniformed Americans at risk, boots on the ground, as you say, well, then there's really no reason for the American public to be concerned about it. They just don't have that much to say. And then we in the executive branch and the heads of these agencies should just be able to decide these things on their own without involving the people. And that's a pernicious attitude, but it's very widely held now among the national security elites in the U.S.
Very few people would disagree that, you know, clearly for the sake of national security, some things do need to be kept secret while other activities could be quite safely disclosed. Are there, though, any repercussions for unnecessarily classifying information?
Well, as the system is structured now, there's no downside, really. So, and I think part of the problem we have right now, if you go back and you look at the executive order that sets the terms and conditions for classification and the legal regime, it's perfectly reasonable. There's very, very little to quibble with it. But then you look at the total quantum of material that's being classified, and it's enough to gag you. You know, I mean, you have a cafeteria menu that may be classified secret. And even the oversight authorities, even within the executive branch, who give an annual report to Congress on this, they always start out by acknowledging that a majority of all classified materials shouldn't be classified. You know, that has horrible consequences to our democracy because of all the things it's taken out of the realm of public knowledge. But there are no negative consequences to the people who do this classifying because the system ratchets only in one direction. So if they make a mistake by not classifying something that they should, there are immediate repercussions for them. But if they overclassify, that's just fine. So I think part of the solution here has to be to address that imbalance.
Attorney Scott Horton is my guest. He's a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, and he has a new book out called Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. You can be part of the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org. Back in 2 minutes with Scott Horton.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with attorney Scott Horton. He teaches at Columbia Law School. He's a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, and he has a new book out called Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Your sense, if I had this right, is that CIA Director John Brennan has very little reason to be concerned about interference in his activities.
That's exactly right. So I think over the last decade, over the last 15 years, the CIA has grown gradually more and more autonomous. It is given a wide range for its activities. It has little to fear for if it messes things up either. I mean, there's been rarely a case of somebody fired or removed, even though there have been a number of really just amazing screw-ups over the last few years. In fact, we would have to say that over this last 15 years, there's been an amazing refocusing of the abilities and capabilities of the CIA onto the Middle East. And yet, when the Arab Spring came about, the CIA just completely missed it, didn't see it coming. And that happened with really no negative repercussions for the agency. Very, very little public criticism, certainly didn't hurt their budget in any way. So they really seem to be immune.
Well, what about last month when the Senate Intelligence Committee report was released that concluded the CIA abused detainees and mismanaged interrogations? That still isn't going to really do anything?
Not so far, and in fact, there was an internal review of the process of obstruction of that investigation, and that review found five CIA agents had behaved improperly. In fact, had seriously misbehaved. and it recommended punishments or sanctions for them. And that went to an internal review board that was put together by Director Brennan, and that board concluded no punishment, no nothing, which is consistent with almost everything else that's happened over the last 10 or 15 years. In fact, one of the things that the Senate report itself concluded, it looked at cases where people have been tortured to death, where there have been just gross errors in judgments and mistakes made, immense sums of money wasted. Not in one single case did you see anyone's career actually suffering as a result of that. In fact, many of the people involved with some of these outlandish mistakes rose right to the top of the agency.
So even lower level employees, are they able to like deliberately use the umbrella of secrecy to shield themselves from scrutiny?
Absolutely, they do. I mean, in fact, they use it. They used it not only with respect to the Senate committee, they've used it with respect to law enforcement activities. So when the Department of Justice and military criminal investigators have looked into matters in which they were involved, they simply say, classified, you have no business looking into this or asking questions about it. And when matters do go forward, they insist it always has to happen on their home court, which is with special prosecutors and this special court in the Eastern District of Virginia.
We have an email here from Joey in Denton who asks if you would speak to sheep dipping within the CIA and how this function simply cuts through any red tape as seen as a safeguard. Is this a glaring representation of how little oversight there is within these organizations? And if you would start, Scott, by explaining what sheep dipping is, that would be helpful.
Well, sheep dipping is the process by which employees in the intelligence community can be shifted between the Department of Defense side and the CIA side, which have different authorities and responsibilities. Of course, this goes back to a very fundamental decision that the architects of the modern national security state made in 1947 when they created the system. There was a decision made that the CIA was going to be pulled out of the military, that it was going to be a civilian agency, but that a lot of activities that were clearly appropriately military activities would be handled by the Department of Defense. And so sheep dipping is a way in which individual employees are just moved from one side of the ledger to the other, constantly on different operations, and which effectively vitiates this distinction. So I would say there was a good reason for this architecture and this divide at the beginning. It served sound policy distinctions, and it's simply been overridden today. And that's how we see, for instance, the CIA operating its own private air force today, which is this predator drone force, and operating its own private armies. That clearly was not supposed to happen the way the rules were laid down in 1947. But I'd say clever bureaucrats in Washington have found ways to just get around these policy distinctions.
Is there reason to be concerned that security agencies in this country are concealing relevant information from the president?
Yes, there is. And in fact, you know, again, if you go back to the beginning, Harry Truman, who was one of the major architects of this system, you know, he really didn't like the idea of the CIA being involved in covert activities. He thought there was a problem with it. He wanted them to be simply analysts of intelligence, not involved in operations. He thought there was a fundamental conflict between being an analyst and running programs. And I think, you know, we see the wisdom of that concern right now with things that came out in the Senate report. You may agree or disagree with policies, but one thing that's very, very clear here is that the CIA constantly misrepresented things because it had been involved in operations and wanted to show those operations as successful even when they weren't. And I think this is just a core area of concern, and it is related to the truthfulness with which they deal with senior figures in the executive. So, and this, I think, is shown by the Senate report, but also shown by earlier studies that were done in the 40s and 50s. The secrecy has resulted in key information being withheld from the president and from other senior officials of the government who need to know that information to make decisions. And I think we saw it with respect to these special programs, the Black Site program and the enhanced interrogation programs. But it's been noted previously with respect to Soviet espionage when there were critical problems that were discovered. It's, you know, we find out that the intelligence community knew about these problems, but they never bothered to tell the president or the Secretary of Defense about them.
What sort of protection exists for whistleblowers, and where does that protection break down?
Well, the protection for whistleblowers in the national security arena is very, very limited. So essentially, it says they can present concerns to the inspectors general in their departments so as to permit an investigation, or they can go to specific congressional oversight committees and raise concerns. And so there's no cover for them to go to the press and disclose a problem to the New York Times, the Washington Post, or any other newspaper. And where this breaks down today is fairly simple. So what we've seen in case after case, and again, the Senate committee documented this pretty well, is when someone came forward and raised a concern, it may have been a completely legitimate concern. In fact, most of the times it had to do with corruption or abuse of a budgetary kind. That is, way too much money was being spent for a program. It wasn't being properly controlled. But as soon as someone came forward and raised those concerns, they showed up as a point of concern for management of the agency. You know, and leadership of the agency thought, well, this person raised a concern about that particular contract and has embarrassed us with that. This person could easily have also been the person who disclosed some super secret information. So everyone who was a whistleblower and raised some problem wound up being very closely scrutinized and spied on. So that's a message to would-be whistleblowers that the danger of speaking and raising concerns about problems, corruption, abuse, excessive payments under contracts, and so forth. This is high risk to raise, to open your mouth and say anything that suggests disagreement with senior management.
Occasionally, whistleblowers will quietly leak something to the media to get facts out that way. But it sounds like, as far as you've characterized it, most of the leaks that actually happen from these agencies to the media are very deliberately planted and not always even factual.
Well, that's correct. Now, of course, you know, your typical federal prosecutor is going to say, no, if they're giving this information to the media, they're not whistleblowers, because this is not what it means to be a whistleblower under the federal statute. And of course, that's true. But one of the really remarkable things that comes out in the Senate report that was just issued back in December is that there was a steady stream of leaks that was given to the media, making important disclosures about these programs. But these really weren't leaks. I mean, leaks are materials that are disclosed against the interests of the institution involved. Well, these were disclosed as part of a propaganda program by the CIA itself. They wanted to ensure that there would be a positive public presentation of their program. It would be presented as a success. So they leaked information that frequently simply wasn't true, but it was accepted really willingly by a number of very prominent reporters whose publications reported it.
Why?
It's only now, of course, that we see that that isn't true.
Yeah, why are these reporters willing to, I mean, on the one hand, it's sometimes hard to fact check information that is otherwise kept completely secret. What are journalists to do about this, and why do you feel like they've capitulated their responsibilities to verify what they've been told?
Well, I think you put your finger on the really difficult aspect of it, and that is things that are enshrouded with secrecy are very difficult to fact check. You just have to go on the bona fides of your source. But I think the problem with a lot of these leaks and these publications is it goes to the idea of leak. So if someone from inside presents you with some materials that you know the information, you know it's information that's harmful to the agency or the agency's reputation, you know, it's trying to suppress it, it's more likely to be true than something that appears to be a propaganda blast, basically. So you have to be, you know, much more skeptical about things that are repeating a formal line that the agency's putting out, because this is the sort of material you would think they would want to put out. And in those cases, you've really got to go back and check. But actually, in both cases, you do, and you need to try and find corroboration for these claims. And when you report it, you need to report the circumstances of the information in such a way that the reader can make informed and independent judgment as to how reliable it is. But I think this is an area in which we now know that there was, you know, there was basically terrible reporting that went on in major media for a period of many years.
Scott Horton is my guest. He's a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of the new book, Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. We'll resume our conversation in a few minutes. If you'd like to join it, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes with our guest, Scott Horton.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with attorney Scott Horton. He is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Scott, how do our geopolitical allies feel about the lack of transparency in American national security functions? Is there reason to believe that it could keep our best partners from working with us in times of crisis?
Well, it's definitely having some problems for us right now. And I'd say, you know, the biggest issues have come from the NSA and our global surveillance network. And our practice of storing mass quantities of data. And I think to get down to the bottom here, you know, we tell everyone this is a counterterrorism operation. They should be working right alongside with us. But a lot of information's come through showing that, no, actually a lot of what the NSA does is try and support American businesses in their competition with foreign businesses. So they may actually spy on a business in France or Germany or Brazil, for that matter, and share this data with their adversary in the United States to help the U.S. business. Well, that may all be fine as a matter of U.S. policy, but you can imagine our allies aren't wild about that, and they're particularly not wild when these surveillance activities go on their soil and in violation of their law. And, of course, the instance that's really captured worldwide attention is the bugging of the phone of Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of West Germany. And I think that people have focused on that. But actually, if you dig much deeper into it, you find out that the NSA was actually bugging the phones of about 130 leading political figures in Germany and on a more casual level, at least 5 million people in Germany. So people there are rather upset about these things. The Germans have pushed, you know, you're doing these operations in Germany, you've got to do them consistently with German law. And to that, the U.S. Reaction so far has been, no, that's inconvenient.
So what kind of oversight might get agencies like the CIA and NSA under control? Is there a role for the courts, for example?
Yes. I spent some time looking at the way the courts dealt with these matters, and I found that by and large, courts are rather supine. So they don't want to get involved in second-guessing the CIA. If the CIA tells them that the situation is so-and-so, they just accept that. Of course, the Senate committee report now makes clear to us that they were lying to and misleading the courts. So that may have some repercussions. But I would say the most important tools really are congressional oversight. I mean, things exactly like the work that the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence has just done, which is, I think, probably the single best, most impressive review of a program that's ever been undertaken by Congress. I mean, that sort of review should be going on in real time and should be going on all the time. That's an important step. But finally, you're going to come back to whistleblowers, frankly. So without the steady flow of information from whistleblowers appearing in responsible media, you're probably not going to have much effective oversight.
Is there reason to be concerned, Scott, that greater oversight, a greater demand for transparency and information provided to the American public could make these agencies any less effective in protecting Americans and American national interests?
Well, they certainly make that case in spades over and over again, that, you know, if we have to share this information with you, if the public knows it, it'll undermine our operations left and right. But I think we've got to say, you know, there's an important dividing point here. That is, the public really doesn't have any legitimate right to know specific tactics. So, you know, the fact that they're going to strike a certain individual at a certain time in a certain location because they believe that person is a terrorist, no, there's really no public right to know that. What the public has a right to know are long-term strategies and policies. And, you know, some information may be necessary so as to define those policies and strategies, but it's at a broader and higher level. And I think what the Lords of Secrecy really need to be doing, and they haven't been doing, is just ensure that there is enough information properly filtered and preened so as to avoid disclosing valuable secrets that's available to the public to allow them to deal with these things on a policy level. And the problem is right now, they really don't want to give the public this information. They don't want to involve the public in decision-making about these issues at all. They want the public to keep out. And that's just not consistent with our basic notions of democracy.
Is it fair for them to assume that members of the public, without full context, simply won't understand what this information means and what should be done with it?
Well, it's, you know, you have to have public discussion and you have to have a process of fully informing the public. But in a democratic society, we don't say the public are all so stupid they could never understand this and meaningfully participate in any way. That happens in authoritarian societies, not in a democratic society. I think the, you know, these Lords of Secrecy have an important role in public discussion. They're people who should be leading the public debate, and they should be explaining patiently why they're taking the approaches, why they're advocating the policies that they're advocating. They should be persuading the people that these things are correct, but withholding all information from the public so that the public isn't informed about these things is not the right approach.
I think the thing that struck me over and over as I was reading the book is that the Lords of Secrecy, as you describe them, the heads of these agencies and their underlings who are not really putting themselves in a position to be held accountable, they're not necessarily bad people. They're not necessarily trying to undermine American interests. And yet they seem not to embrace the idea that the country they are serving has a right to know what they're up to.
That's exactly right. And this goes back to things that, you know, this famous German sociologist Max Weber observed about 100 years ago. He said that, you know, you create national security bureaucracies, and they're always going to do this. I mean, they just take on a life of their own, and the bureaucracy wants a bigger budget, wants more employment lines, wants a greater say, and that will lead to this tactical use of secrecy to keep others out and to build up their power and authority. So it's not consciously anti-democratic, but the effects of it, especially over many decades, are definitely anti-democratic. They present a real peril to the country that has to be carefully checked. And I think American policymakers, going back to the period after World War II, it's amazing when you go back and you look at their reviews. They were very conscious of this problem. They worked very, very hard to rein it in and control it. But the sorts of measures that they recommended back right after World War II are no longer being followed and applied by our government. That's part of our problem today.
Why do you think the outcry among American voters has been relatively muted? And what does that say about the state of our information culture today?
Yeah, well, we have an immediate explanation for that, which is secrecy. So secrecy really is the most effective narcotic that democratic society has ever known. Mm-hmm. So you don't know much about something, you're not likely to get concerned about it. So having information creates interest, and interest is contagious. So you really get down to this basic question of whether people know. But it also has to do with some of the tools that we're using. So if you compare the situation today back to, let's say, the Vietnam War era, where people really were, on both sides of the ledger, very aggressively involved and deeply concerned about what was going on, with to today, where maybe they have an opinion, but they don't really care about it that much. a lot of that has to do with the fact that before they had a son, a daughter, a cousin, a father, a grandfather who was involved at war, who was at risk. Today, we went to a volunteer army, we ratcheted down our military presence, we moved to military contractors, and now we're moving into this phase of robotic weaponry where there really is very, very little physical risk to American military personnel. And I think this, in part, this reflects conscious choices to ratchet down the interest of the American public in things so that the Lords of Secrecy have far broader discretion, far bigger say about what is to be done. And that's a bad thing for our democratic culture.
Scott Horton is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, a practicing lawyer, and a lecturer at Columbia Law School. His new book is called Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Scott, thank you so much for spending this day with us. I'm glad that we were able to talk to you despite the bad weather where you are, and I hope you're staying warm.
Well, it's a great pleasure for me, and I hope everything goes well with the KERA fund drive.
Thank you so much.